From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Coast Guard's seen a big jump in phony distress calls from the Great Lakes, and every wasted search costs taxpayers a lot of money.
These response boats on average cost $4,500 an hour just to operate. The helicopters can range up to $16,000 an hour.
What it's like to be black and Muslim in Michigan in 2017.
There's a lot of money in terrorizing people and fear-mongering and things like that.
The lakeside ghost town of Singapore. Some call it Michigan's Pompeii, done in by a dune.
One of the last inhabitants was a local fisherman, and he was in a building, and as the sand filled in the first story of his building, he just moved to the second floor.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll talk about what it means to be black and Muslim in America.
Islam is as American as baseball, as apple pie.
There are a lot of differences in this religion, culturally, politically. So even within us, we're not a monolith.
But first, the plan to link four Southeast Michigan counties with one regional transit system failed last November at the ballot box, rejected by some 18,000 votes. And that has the Regional Transit Authority of Southeast Michigan looking for ways to make the plan more appealing to more voters. One approach being talked about, trimming the size of the proposed area. With us now is Megan Owens, Executive Director of Transportation Riders United. Megan, why do you think the regional transit plan failed last November? What went wrong?
Well, it was actually extraordinarily close. And given that this four-county region of not only Detroit and Wayne County, Oakland, Macomb, but also Washtenaw County, this region has never before been asked if they're willing to fund to pay for public transit as a whole. And so the fact that 894,000 people were in fact willing to make that investment was in fact a great positive step. The challenge was slightly more said no. So you're right, there's definitely some more work to be done, both in making sure the plan really fits what each community needs, but also helping people who haven't had a lot of experience with transit to learn more about how it can benefit them, their lives, and their communities.
So the plan and the messaging both need work.
Exactly. The reality is it's been more than 60 years since we've had a robust public transit system in this region, and so a large number of voters have never really experienced transit or a well-connected transit system. They may use it when they go to New York or D.C. or Chicago, but they can't quite picture it here. So we at Transportation Riders United are going to be taking on an effort to reach out and have more conversations across the region to help people realize, even if you don't personally use transit, here's how your community, your family, your neighbors, and your life can be better off. But you're right, the RTA also is also looking at some ways that they could modify the transit plan of what they're offering or modify the region of who should be a part of this.
Yeah, so we're hearing that they're looking at a smaller region. And what do you think about that?
I think it's at least worth considering. There have been a lot of areas around the country that the first time they've asked their voters to make a major investment in public transit, voters have been a little shy, not as excited to do that, especially because when you get way out in some of the rural or exurban areas, it's both very hard to provide transit out there, and to some extent people have made choices that they prefer a more rural area. They acknowledge and accept that they need to drive everywhere they want to go. And so maybe some of the far western parts of Washtenaw County, the far northern parts of Oakland and Macomb, where actually the largest numbers of people voted no, maybe those parts don't need to be part of the region. Still, a vast majority of Southeast Michigan could be connected, going everywhere from Mount Clemens and Pontiac out to Novi, Ann Arbor, and down to the airport and downriver. You could still connect a very large portion of the population in the region and just not stretch so far to reach the entire part of the area. A lot of things need to be evaluated as to how to make that happen quickly, because we really do want to try to get back on the ballot in next November, November of 2018. But it's certainly worth exploring and has gotten a lot of positive feedback so far.
As you think about the politics behind shrinking that footprint and the need for support from county executives and Detroit's mayor, that's important. And as we know, Oakland County's Al Brooks Patterson and Macomb County's Mark Hackle were not on board last time. And as you say, there's where the no votes came from.
Yeah, there were a lot more of the no votes in those areas, Wayne and Washtenaw counties, both their political leaders as and elected officials, as well as a majority of the voters, did in fact support this. So there is additional talk as should Wayne and Washtenaw counties move forward on their own. If Oakland and Macomb don't want to get on board, at least we can start making some progress connecting people across the two counties to the airport, to each other, et cetera. But I think most people agree that it would be great to be able to include the southern parts of Oakland and Macomb County, where there is certainly a lot of people, a lot of jobs, a lot of destinations. The Oakland County leadership have expressed great interest in this idea of shrinking the footprint. Their biggest concern last year was what the areas in the far northern communities would be receiving beyond some senior and disability shuttles to ensure people could get to doctors' appointments, et cetera. There wasn't a lot of direct service. So he has expressed a lot of interest in this idea of sure, if Southern Oakland County wants to be a part of this and wants to vote to invest in transit without making the northern parts pay, the Oakland County leadership has expressed a lot more interest in that possibility.
And what are we hearing from Mark Hackle in Macomb County?
We have not heard a whole lot there yet.
To be determined.
Yeah, I should say, I'm obviously not in on the conversations
right
between the executives. So the good thing is they are actively talking, and we applaud that with the leadership of Wayne County Executive Warren Evans, the Big Four in Washtenaw County. They are talking about how to move this forward, because the reality is the needs for public transit have not gone away. There are still tens of thousands of people struggling to get to jobs, struggling to get to job training and educational programs, struggling to basically live a vibrant life if they can't drive. And so it's still vitally important and urgent that this transit crisis be addressed. So we applaud any effort to move that forward.
Megan Owens, Executive Director of Transportation Riders United. Megan, thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
The U.S. Coast Guard has a message for everyone. Knock it off with the prank calls. They're seeing a big jump in fake distress calls, more than 160 made across the Great Lakes so far this year. With us now is Coast Guard Petty Officer 3rd Class Brian McCrum. Brian, what kind of hoax calls are we talking about?
So a false distress or hoax mayday call, we're talking about those that are made either by the phone, over a marine radio, just basically a person claiming to be in distress who is knowingly and willfully intending to deceive. So we're not talking about those instances where someone in good faith makes a call or sees something on the water that, you know, they think could be a person in the water and they call. Those we do kind of categorize as false alarms. But the hoax maydays are particularly those where someone is intentionally just trying to play a prank on the Coast Guard and waste the taxpayers' money.
Boy, and let's talk about that a little bit. When somebody decides it would be pretty funny to see what happens if they put in a hoax mayday call, What happens in terms of resources? How do you respond and what does it cost?
So we go out every time there's a call, no matter what. We're always ready to go out, and that's our job. So we're not going to sit there and speculate whether this is real or not. Typically, we respond as soon as there's an urgent marine information broadcast sent over the radio. We send out one of our response boats, often launch a helicopter as well from Air Station Detroit. These response boats, on average, cost $4,500 an hour just to operate. The helicopters can range up to $16,000 an hour.
Oh, boy. And you could spend, you know, hours and hours in search of someone who's supposedly missing.
Yeah, exactly. If we don't have the information on them before the night is done, we continue searching through the night in most cases with all our available assets.
Okay, I'm interested in whether if the Coast Guard's able to track down whoever it is thought it would be funny to make that call. Have you ever heard what the reasoning was? What was the excuse?
You know, I really couldn't speculate as to the why or try to get in someone's head who would try to, you know, intentionally deceive if they're knowingly doing it. We do prosecute, though. It is completely illegal, so you can face up to 6 years in prison, a $250,000 fine, $5,000 civic penalty, also just possible reimbursement to the Coast Guard for the cost of performing that search.
And you're putting other people at danger, because what happens if the Coast Guard's out looking for the phony missing boat? What happens when there is a real distress call?
That's exactly it. We have a limited amount of assets that we can use for any particular case. You know, there was a false distress call on Monday, so we went out, and other cases that were going on at that time, you know, nothing major happened, but, you know, those assets that were being used, we searched overnight for a mayday call that was made by a little kid saying his father fell in the water. You know, those could have been used for another real search and rescue case.
Now, I know the Coast Guard spent all this past night looking for a couple of missing kayakers in Lorain, Ohio, and that actually proved to be not a problem. They did turn up safe, but that wasn't a prank call, was it?
No. In that case, these kayaks were rented out from a place in Lorain about 6:30 p.m. They were supposed to be back by sunset, and they didn't come back. So we actually got the call from the owner of the boat launch. So he was, you know, in good faith saying, hey, well, first of all, these are my kayaks, so what happened to them? And you know, these people could be in distress. So we launched immediately. It was around 10:30 p.m. We had a 25-footer response boat on the scene, as well as an MH-65 helicopter from Detroit got there about midnight. Canadian Royal Air Force went ahead and sent out a C-130 as well, got there about 4 a.m. So we searched through the night, and a little before 6 a.m. this morning, the kayaks were found. And case closed on our end. Local Lorain County Police Department will continue the investigation as to the two people who are missing.
And as you say, he was right to call. So you're not saying to people, don't call the Coast Guard.
Exactly. That's why we're putting out this press release. That's why we've been doing a lot of stories on this recently, because we don't want people to be scared if, you know, if their kid's messing around the radio or something, or if you're doing a communications check, it gets misinterpreted as a distress call or something. If you know, or if you know of someone who accidentally put out a false distress, go ahead and give your local Coast Guard station a call, and we'll cancel it immediately. And, you know, that's us working together. We don't want to scare people from calling us.
Fair enough. Coast Guard Petty Officer 3rd Class Brian McCrum, thank you so much for speaking with us, and thanks for what you do to keep our lake safe.
Yeah, no problem.
Up next, a Michigan ghost town done in by the sands of time.
One of the last inhabitants was a local fisherman, and he was in a building, and as the sand filled in the first story of his building, he just moved to the second floor.
And then in 10 minutes, we'll look at the music of West Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
When you hear the words ghost town, you might imagine a dusty, vacant town in the Old West where cowboys once tread. Well, think again, because our own state has its share of ghost towns. It's Wednesday, and time to talk Michigan history with our partner at the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Mark, this might sound strange, but we're going to be talking about Singapore, specifically Singapore, Michigan. Where is that?
It is just north of present-day Saugatuck, down in southwest Michigan, just off the shore of Lake Michigan.
So here it is, right along Lake Michigan. So a potential future port city. Is that how it earned the name Singapore?
Yeah, it was an intentional naming. I didn't realize that the Singapore in Asia hadn't, it was just a sleepy fishing community until around 1819. And then it exploded in growth over the next 8 to 10 years. And so this is 1836. It's not that far after that. And they thought, hey, maybe we can catch lightning in a bottle and use a flashy name that's caught a lot of attention and attract people to this prospective important port city in Michigan.
So we're talking about like the early 1800s, very early in Michigan's history then, when Singapore, Michigan was established.
Yeah, right around statehood. Statehood's 1837, and O'Shea Wilder and his sons came from New York and bought up some land near the mouth of the Kalamazoo River and envisioned an important port town.
Besides the lakefront view, what else might entice people to come? What kind of jobs were there?
Well, there actually wasn't a great lakefront view. There was a large dune that blocked that view, and that dune's going to come into play in this story in just a little bit. But people came because a couple main reasons. There was a lot of good virgin white pine timber in this area, so it had a ready resource of timber. So sawmills were built, and that drew people for employment, both logging and in the sawmills. And then there was another, you know, this is a important time of speculation in Michigan, and there was something called the Clinton-Kalamazoo Canal. So we're before railroads were a factor in transportation, and there was something called the canal craze. Michigan had it bad. We were trying to look for easy transportation routes across the interior of the state, and they drew up this plan for a canal that went from Macomb, Clinton Township, over Macomb, all the way across the state to the mouth of the Kalamazoo River. And this was going to make, this set Singapore up to be the port entry for Great Lakes shipping. But
it never happened. I hear a great big but.
But it didn't get very far.
And so we're talking Michigan ghost town. So what brought on the demise of Singapore?
I think a lot of factors. One was that the town really would have been better positioned at the actual mouth of the river, right on the lake. But O'Shea Wilder couldn't, as the story has been recorded, couldn't secure that actual piece of land. So it had to compromise and go a little bit further inland. As is the case with most logging operations, after a certain point, you run out of trees. So that factored into it. They also had some problems with wildcat banking. Listeners might remember a previous story we did on that. So
yeah, remind us again about wildcat banking.
So wildcat banking was this wonderful idea to democratize banking in Michigan, and the general banking law allowed any 50 people to open a bank. Mm-hmm. Anybody could open a bank, you too. So they did, with disastrous results. So that didn't help the community's financial standing either. So between the canal speculation failing and the wildcat banking scandal and eventually running out of timber and the position of the town, those were all things that factored into its demise. It hung on longer than most.
How long? How long did it linger?
Until the 1870s. I think 1875 is one of the dates that is typically listed.
And Mark, 1871 was a rather historic year in terms of fires, wasn't it?
It was. There was fires, the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, and even surrounding communities, there was significant fires in Wisconsin, Holland, Michigan, just north of Singapore. And what that did is really set up an increased demand for lumber. Again, this is 1871. This is right in the heart of the pine era, and Singapore went into overdrive, and that deforestation left a lot of area ripe for erosion, including that dune that was just on the west side of the town.
Strip away the trees, that sand's going to blow.
Yep. That dune became a problem because it was not a stable dune. The sand started shifting, and it started just infilling the buildings in town.
There's a problem.
That's a problem. There was one story, again, ghost town story, so readers beware, but there was one of the last inhabitants was a local fisherman, and he was in a building, and as the sand filled in the first story of his building, he just moved to the second floor. Eventually, the buildings that could be saved were taken downriver to Saugatuck and used there, and people resettled there.
So is there anything, if tourists are in that area around Saugatuck, would they see any trace of Singapore, or is it completely wiped out?
There's a historic marker near Saugatuck talking about the history of Singapore, but it's completely covered by the dune. It's been called Michigan's Pompeii.
That's poetic, very, very poetic. But there are records about the town still that can be found, still in existence.
Yes, and there's still a Singapore Yacht Club. I believe it's mostly private land around where the town site was. But there's lots of records, both in the Saugatuck Douglas Historical Society in Saugatuck and at the Archives of Michigan.
The story of the ghost town of Singapore, Michigan, also known as Michigan's Pompeii. That's the Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Time now to check out West Michigan's music scene and sample some of the artists, thanks to John Sinkovich, who's editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com, a website that covers West Michigan's music scene. Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much. It's been an incredibly busy summer already with a crazy number of Michigan music festivals, and a lot of them, of course, showcase regional and local artists. So Local Spins has been very busy sort of covering and running all over the state, sort of covering this stuff, and it's been a lot of fun so far.
Great. Well, this time around, we've got a very diverse group of musicians to explore. We're going to start with In the Valley Below and this new release, the Elephant EP. So who's in this group?
Well, this Grand Rapids indie rock and dream pop group revolves around musicians and singers Jeffrey Jacob and Angela Gale. They're a married couple. They met in L.A. and made a splash a few years ago, actually, in Los Angeles with their first full-length major label album, The Belt, which also produced the single Peaches. It got them on a lot of best albums of the year lists. It put them on late-night network television shows. It got them on the road across the country and even overseas. But they got kind of tired of the whole L.A. maelstrom, I think, just in terms of living there. And because Angie grew up here in the Muskegon area and attended Grand Valley State University, they decided to move back more than a year ago to Grand Rapids. They bought a house on the southeast side, set up a recording studio in the basement, and started working on their next project, which happens to be the Elephant EP. And they are truly a unique couple, and they also have a drummer who joins them on stage as well, in the sense that they are an indie rock band with very muscular, powerful stage presence, and yet they have this dream pop milieu that sort of envelops their music as well. They are really, I see a lot of impressive bands and acts out of the West Michigan area, but this one really piqued my interest and perked up my ears as well.
Let's hear a bit of a song called Pink Chateau off of the Elephant EP. Their sound strike you? How do you describe their sound, John?
Well, it's interesting. I've had them in the studio here in the Grand Rapids area and talked to them sort of in a casual setting where they play things acoustically, and they're very laid back, and their songs are very compelling, very insightful. In fact, their first single off of this album is entitled Blood Hands Oh My Fever, which was released last month along with a striking video, and that's really been inspired by the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. So they're not afraid to tackle some of these tough issues, and yet at the same time, when you see them on stage in concert, they dress in white, they have a very dynamic sound, it comes across much more powerfully and much more like a rock band in concert. I really love the way they incorporate some of the elements of their electronic sort of flavors along with what really amounts to really great indie rock. In fact, when you see them live, they'll even throw in covers of songs like Tom Petty and Stevie Nicks, which really are unusual.
Let's take a listen to part of another track, Hold On Tight. Does this group in the Valley Below have in Michigan and nationally?
Nationally, they definitely have a following, mostly obviously on the West Coast, and they're really starting to pick up steam here. They said they moved to Grand Rapids and were very impressed by the talent base here and the ability to be able to collaborate with a lot of other musicians, and they love it here. Peter Fox at Stonehouse Recording has helped them out with their new album as well, and he's going to be touring with them as a sound guy. They're actually kicking off their national tour later this month. They kick it off on July 13th with a show at the Loving Touch in Ferndale, and they'll be touring the country behind this new EP. And I'm thinking they're going to develop a huge audience because they really have an impressive approach.
Next up, we have a jazz organ trio who are clearly huge Beatles fans. Here's Organissimo doing the Beatles tune Come Together. Thank you. John, tell us about this group and their new album.
So I've known these guys for a long, long time. They actually were formed way back in 2000. Hammond B3 virtuoso Jim Alfredson of Lansing and drummer Randy Marsh of Grand Rapids are currently joined by guitarist Larry Barris these days. But they create this organ-based jazz and soul music. It has some elements of rock in it. It has some elements of the blues in it. And they're an instrumental trio, and they have toured all over the globe as well. And this is actually their sixth album, so they've been doing this for quite some time. And the new album, they have this love for the Fab Four, and they started talking about the idea of maybe we could do our own sort of take, a jazzy take on the Beatles. And what came out is this really striking arrangements of classic Beatles tunes, stuff that really, I think, really shows off not only their talent as sort of wonderful instrumentalists, but also sort of gives Beatles fans something new to sort of latch on to.
Indeed. Here's Organissimo's version of Taxman. You know, somehow you just know Lennon and McCartney would be all about other artists taking their songs and putting their own personal spin on it, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think the whole idea of music of this point is to really do something different with it. I mean, a lot of people might want to hear things exactly the way they were recorded originally, but I think a lot of people appreciate the fact that a really good musician can do something different with a song that people are familiar with.
Now let's turn to the Jim Scheinberger Band with their new album, Above and Below. Here's Ain't Your Daddy's Blues. About Jim and his band.
Yeah, guitarist and singer Jim Scheinberger has been a real mainstay here in the Grand Rapids area for many years, and it's really only the past 5 years or so that he's really stepped out with his band and emerged as one of West Michigan's sort of preeminent blues and blues rock outfits. In fact, many years ago, when I first met and interviewed Jim, he was really a sideman in bands. He was playing bass for a lot of musicians here in the Grand Rapids area, including Chicago legend Donald Kinsey, after Kinsey had moved to the Grand Rapids area. But truth be told, after hearing him go solo, Jim is a monster on electric guitar, a great singer to boot. So it's really not surprising that he's fronting and driving this super talented trio of musicians, which recently released this new album called Above and Below. And I think he's pretty committed to the notion, too, that it's not just the blues. This album spans everything from funk and soul to southern rock. And I know he's even assembled some really impressive tributes to Prince over the past year or so. So he really does have a rich background to lean on. And where does the Jim Scheinberger Band tend to play? Where can people find them? They're in the Grand Rapids area for the most part. He plays regularly across Michigan from Grand Rapids to the Lakeshore. He plays every week. Essentially, you can find Jim somewhere in a nightclub or at a cafe somewhere in the Grand Rapids area. And I know that he's also performed out of state as well. And the new album really does show off his licks on guitar.
So to recap, In the Valley Below with Elephant EP, Organissimo, Beatles, a soulful tribute to the Fab Four, and the Jim Schoenberger Band, Above and Below. And you can find out lots more about these and all other kinds of artists by going to localspins.com, edited and published by my guest, John Sinkovich. John, thanks so much for the tour of some of the best music Michigan has to offer.
Absolutely. And I might give a real quick shameless plug here for those looking for more about West Michigan's music scene. We actually put out a greatest hits album of our own, Local Spins did, with 12 West Michigan acts, and recorded in an intimate setting at River City Studios here. You might want to check that out as well, because it really gives you a nice display of what's happening over here in this region.
Super. Thanks so much. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, what it's like to be both Black and Muslim in Michigan.
The popular narrative is to demonize and otherize Islam from being American.
After the break, our conversation with two members of the religious community. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our mission here on Stateside is to bring you as many different voices from our diverse state as we possibly can. With anti-Muslim rhetoric seemingly intensifying and the daily reminders of our nation's long, painful, and still unresolved history when it comes to race relations, we wanted to understand what it means to be Black and Muslim in Michigan right now. With us to help us understand this perspective are Dr. Halim Naeem. He's a psychologist at Naeem & Associates in Livonia, and Tahira Khalid, head counselor at Muslim Family Services in Detroit. Welcome to both of you. It is so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Honored to be here.
I'm going to start really right out of the gate. I'm going to toss this one at you. And Tahira, I'm going to start with you. What does it mean to be Black and Muslim in America at this moment in our history?
A realization that all identity now carries a power. And it depends on how well-versed people are in terms of knowledge about alternative communities as to how they react. It depends on how I walk through the world, and I attempt by being a Muslim to walk in peace and be prepared for opposite reactions. But I've been blessed not to have a great deal of negativity come at me. I've been really surprised in the political atmosphere that we live in now. The people have really worked very diligently to find out what it does mean to be a Muslim.
When you say the people, who?
Neighbors. Basic people in stores.
People who are not Muslim, who want to know more?
Are really hungry about what this means. I've been really touched in my heart by how much effort people are working to narrow the divide. I just was driving through in Ann Arbor because we had extra time, and I saw, I guess it was a fraternity house, say that we love and respect Muslims and immigrants. That was a sign.
Wow.
And it was just heartening to see that. If people have a problem with me being African-American and Muslim, people basically, unless they're on some kind of fringe, have enough political consciousness not to come right out. But that can be a blessing as well as a problem.
Halim, what's been your experience?
Well, it's a lot of things, being Black and Muslim. Number one, there's, you know, we're talking about history and a context of how we come into society, of how we're positioned in society. Mm-hmm. And it means a couple of layers of marginalization, discrimination, and at many times in popular media, we're demonized at a number of different levels. You know, every night you see on Channel 7 news and different things like that, and the faces of people who actually commit certain crimes. And then, you know, on top of that, you have Muslims, and you have Black Muslims, and you have this push that we see of Islam to be something exotic, to be something not American, to be not part of our culture. Islam is as American as baseball, as apple pie, as a number of different things.
With deep historic roots.
With very deep historic roots. And a lot of things, we look at history of how our government runs and different things like that, it's been taken from a lot of patterns have been taken from Islamic traditions. So with me, I have a few hats that are worn that are marginalized, that I would say just the name being Muslim, you know, people don't think about when you're applying to jobs, when you're applying and, you know, doing certain things, how that'll demonize you applying to schools and different things like that when people see you and everything.
I'm very interested in if you've sensed a change since President Trump's election in the months since. And Tahira, as you describe people kind of going out of their way, or the sign that you saw today coming into Ann Arbor, do you think there are people that are kind of trying to go the extra mile to maybe offset some of the narrative?
I think people are very curious. I think people now are struggling to find out where they stand. I see with myself, and I know Halim, Dr. Halim, people I've even seen in meetings. I sit on several boards. I'm very involved in the academic world, clinical world. I live in a lot of worlds that I find people are constantly trying to figure me out. Who is she and how does her Islam and heritage impact my relationship with her? And I can't say it's always positive. It's a huge curiosity. I'm very upset with the media, as Halima said, and the way the narrative is played out. The images are very powerful. Images teach.
What images that you see that
I see the images that I don't see. I don't see the image of the African-American Muslim woman presented at all. Mm-hmm. If they interview someone, it is an Arab hijabi woman, and that's my sister. But there are a lot of differences in this religion, culturally, politically. So even within us, we're not a monolith. We're a vast array of people, a huge number. I think I saw a statistic, the large majority of babies that will be born in this country by 2035 will be Muslim babies. Mm. There's a huge population that now exists in our country, but each set of individuals have a different understanding, education. I see America grappling with what that means for their own well-being, but the media images are not positive. And media is one that I've talked to media people. Well, we go for the controversy. Go for the controversy, but show some of the positive images. We have a clinic that was set up by the Muslim Center of Detroit called the Huda Clinic. It's a federally protected clinic that serves the poor and underserved populations in the city. We had a huge fundraiser about a couple months ago. The medical school sends staff. We have pharmacy, dermatology, ophthalmology, everyone is in that clinic. So we have a huge fundraiser to help support the money that the federal grant doesn't cover. We had a cross-section of cultures, religions, Americans. We had European Americans. We actually saw a news truck pull up because they saw this huge number of people coming to the Muslim Center, stop and pull away. That would have been an excellent story to show that we are working to take care of the medically underserved in this country. And we're working as European Americans, Black Americans, we're professionals.
And that story didn't get told.
The head of the health department at the time was Dr. Abdul Al Said spoke. He's Arab, a brother that's now running for governor. Mm-hmm. It would have been an excellent narrative to change the pejorative view of us being a drain on the society and not being of great benefit.
But that's the thing. The popular narrative, and there's a lot of benefit that comes out from it. There's a lot of money in terrorizing people and fear-mongering and things like that. So, I mean, you know, you don't have to search far for it. But the popular narrative is to demonize and otherize Islam from being American.
That goes back in American history.
Exactly.
Somebody was always the other.
Yes. Exactly.
Somebody was always
exactly.
the other.
And
it's,
why?
And it's, and, you know, it's our turn now. You know, we have an interest as Black people and as Muslim people. We have an interest in the sustainability of the integrity of this country. And we Black people see ourselves as being the economic foundation of the country because we are. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of people built their empires of wealth and everything like that. You don't have to go that far into history books. So we've always been gung-ho. We've always been on the team of, all right, let's try and make this a better place for everyone. Now, you know, again, people get their turns. The Chinese got their turn in the 40s. And, you know, well, Black people have been having their turn since
the beginning.
And, you know, even 100 years ago, Jews and Irish people or whatever. But for us to use these tactics towards whole communities and other groups of people so that a select few can have this type of life and sustain themselves, that's not going to last. That's not going to be a sustainable method for a country.
We're talking about what it means to be Black and Muslim in Michigan as we talk with Tahira Khalid, who's head counselor at Muslim Family Services in Detroit, and Dr. Halim Naeem, who's a psychologist based in Livonia. Halim, how is the Muslim religion generally perceived by the larger African-American community?
It's mixed view. And there's a historical context to that. But I think a lot of media has started to slant it, quite frankly, a little more towards a negative direction. There used to be a lot of respect, like when I was younger. I'm 35 years old. And I remember when I was single digits, in the 80s and in the 90s, there was a tremendous amount of respect for Islam within the Black community.
What's changed?
A number of things. One, the overall position towards Islam, I think, to really demonize it at a whole nother level has changed. And then two, I think that the growth of Muslims and people seeing more Muslims rather than Islam, people coming up short on what their ideals and what their principles are supposed to be. So now
people who don't represent true
essentially, yes. People don't necessarily represent Islam mm-hmm. as it's actually intended mm-hmm. because over time, like mm-hmm. Sister Tahira is saying, there's more people, mm-hmm. more babies, more growth. Mm-hmm. And again, I would attribute a lot of this. Okay, this is not just an African-American issue. This is also, you have to look at this in the context of institutionalized racism mm-hmm. and the breakup of families mm-hmm. and the astronomical distribution and financial oppression, mm-hmm. just poverty. Mm-hmm. So when you have other things that affect people, when you have these things that affect households and you take certain habits and take certain survival tactics and ways to cope, then you're not going to necessarily always represent, you know, the best ideals.
Tahira, I'm interested in what you've seen through your life, the relationship between people in Black Muslim American communities and immigrant or non-Black American Muslims.
I had the privilege of being raised Muslim. My father accepted Islam in the early 50s. He rejected Christianity because he felt that that was a tool to keep us oppressed, that if we had been enslaved as a people. This is one of the most egregious enslavements. Slavery has always existed in the world. But the narrative of a Western and particularly American is now being documented by many historians, many of whom are European. But as we look and read the histories, the egregious enslavement of our people, which was called chattel slavery, we've actually been put in the status with animals, which mm-hmm. would justify the inhumanity which we've endured. We were sold away. There were even rules in slavery around the world. Baby would not be sold from its mother. We were enslaved. We were raped. I was looking at some Sinhalese brothers who came to the masjid mm-hmm. recently. Mm-hmm. They are the color of this headphone. Mm-hmm. They are black, that you realize that that's where we started and where this we have truly been mixed within the various cultures biologically in terms of heredity. So my father rejected if a group of people could rape my mother, sell my children on the slave block. But if they come to me with a Bible, a religious document, why would I accept it? Huh. It has to be part of a narrative of marginalization. It has to be a trick. My father rejected Christianity as part of a tool of oppression.
So you have spent your whole life in Islam. In, mm-hmm.
So what I've seen, yeah. I've seen a greater respect as Islam has grown. Mm-hmm. What I am aware of is the programming of non-Black people that starts in the Middle East. So when they come here, mm-hmm. they're anti-African-American because they've been trained to be anti-African-American when they get here. And I've had to tell some of the immigrants, you're here because of the civil rights movement that my family made. Mm. My family, my ancestors were beaten and raped, but still put together voting's right. We marched, and that door opened up the opportunity for all of you to come here. So for you not to give me salams, because you were told that if I'm African-American, that I'm less than a person, that's on you. See, one thing about the world.
Do they hear you when you say that?
Yeah, they have to think about that.
Do you
that.
See the walls mm-hmm. coming mm-hmm. down?
Yes, mm-hmm. we presented that. Dr. Halim had me present a conference, and people sort of blew back. It becomes very difficult sometimes for us to continually wear that badge, but I'm not that person. I will tell the truth. So many times we apologize. A lot of the enslavement uh-huh. and the chattel enslavement, which allowed us to be three-fifths of people, even in the Constitution, has us so diminished. We're ashamed. So we're constantly finding a way to keep the discussion from happening because mm-hmm. we don't want to be mm-hmm. heard anymore. I'm not afraid of that. Let us put the truth on the table so we can redo it. So the truth is there's a lot of division, divisiveness that's programmed and planted among communities, once again for the benefit of a few people who are mm-hmm. at the top and who use that to keep us at odds with each other so they can control us all.
Yeah, anti-blackness is mm-hmm. not just a phenomenon that's yeah. in America. Yeah. This is something that has grown, that's been the case. The issue is, and I mean, it's a history thing because we got to be real, and you're talking about colonization that already had anti-black sentiments coming into Arabized communities and chopping up the Middle East. That's why it's called the Middle East and mm-hmm. all this other stuff 300-500 years ago and chopping that stuff up and getting in there and educating and teaching people certain things.
Passing
what's right.
along the attitudes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. What's right and what's wrong. And now you come here and now people who look like me are supposed to simply be scrubbing toilets and whatever. That comes across in a number of different ways when there's this, superiority complex. And then you have African-American people, because of the trauma and internalized racism, they've transferred that. They've transferred that from, you know, from trying to be like master, from trying to be like European-American to trying to ascend religiously as an immigrant.
All right. I have to ask about something that I'm sure, especially you, Tahira, growing up through your life as Muslim, how do you address people, and let's be honest, white people, who think that black Muslims just hate white folks, and they get stopped right there.
So I was working on a project at the DMC, and one of the nurses walked up and said, we had a very good relationship, and then she came up to me and she said, oh, I didn't know you're Muslim. Okay, you didn't. And so she said, my uncle said you all hate white people. I said, you know what, I'm not going to go on that narrative with you. I just want to ask you, how have I treated you? How have I treated you? I said, now, you were learning your catechisms about a month ago, and you want to repeat them to someone to make sure that you got to the next level in your religion. Nobody would listen to those verses but me. She stopped. She said, I have to think about that. I said, you know, we have people in the world, your uncle, I don't know where that came from. I don't know what he understands. The only thing I can go on now is my relationship with you. Have I done anything to diminish you or mistreat you? She came back the next day and she hugged me, said I was wrong. But I'm glad you put it on the table. There are some people, I had a secretary whose husband came in and saw me. She turned totally different. And I asked her, I said, what happened with us? And she said, well, my husband said you hate white people. I said, once again, what have I done? But it wasn't enough for her because her relationship with him. And what is his knowledge base? I haven't grown up as a Muslim, though. I've seen the respect of Islam grow, especially in the African-American community. See, this is a very divided society. We as African-Americans have to interact with everyone. I interact with Europeans, Arabs. European-Americans many times don't see anyone except the ones in their own little communities. And they've told me, well, if all the rest of black people are like you. I've had a professor up at U of M, one of my clinical professors, saying, Tahira, if everybody else was like you. I said, well, first of all, how many black people do you know? And I'm no different than you. Can't insult my people and honor me. Most African Americans are doing the same thing. And we have the sideline, the sidewinders. We mm-hmm. have the little people mm-hmm. on the side, not well, trying to raise their families, feed their families, educate their families. That's what most people are doing. You don't know any black people. And so you judge, and I'm not necessarily an example, but you've taken the media narrative. I don't hear those conversations, people who are enlightened who've gone out to seek. So basically, it's just a lack of knowledge.
Tahira Khalid is head counselor at Muslim Family Services in Detroit, and Dr. Halim Naeem is a psychologist who's based in Livonia. Thank you so much to both of you for being
with
us.
Thank you for the honor to be here. What a blessing. You're part of the new change.
Yeah, great.
Our program today was directed by Ellie Billings, engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.